Hey, this is Kevin from Kevin's Barbecue Joints, and welcome to episode 213 of the Kevin's Barbecue Joints podcast. And I am super excited to bring you my interview with Brian Flannery from Flannery Beef. That's flannerybeef.com. Katie Flannery and Brian Flannery, who own Flannery Beef, are putting out incredible, incredible product. All prime beef. They're using Holstein cows. This interview is so interesting. If you're just listening to the podcast, check this out on the YouTube side at youtube.com/kevinsbbqjoints. That way you get a chance to see Brian. He is super passionate about this. His father was a butcher. His brothers are butchers. They have the family business. He broke off. He tells the entire story. They're up in Marin County. But he talks about the details of owning this business and what Flannery Beef is all about. We get into dry aging versus wet aging, which is extremely interesting. Every question that I pose to him, he gives a very detailed and amazing answer. We also talk about aging and how many days he feels aging has gone too far. It's almost a shame to go too into this into the interview because Brian is so eloquent and so interesting. So I know that you guys are going to love this. You'll learn a lot about beef, learn a lot about Flannery Beef, all the things they offer. There's so much. Their website is incredible. Just check it out at flannerybeef.com. I'll put links to below to the website as well as specific places within the website because they have some cool stuff like gift boxes and mismatched pieces. And one really cool thing is that when you do order, everything is cut to order. All the meats are cut to order before they ship them to you. But say you order 4 New Yorks, they will cut the 4 New Yorks to match because they know that you're using those possibly for a dinner party. So they want them to match. It's the level of detail that Katie and Brian put into this business is phenomenal. So again, check them out, flannerybeef.com. I can't thank Brian enough for doing this. And at the very beginning of this interview, if you're on the YouTube side, you'll see Katie. She sets up the computer for him, so you'll get a chance to see her as well. And the Kevin's Barbecue Joints podcast and YouTube show is brought to you by Treaty Oak Distilling. That's treatyoakdistilling.com. They have a physical location that you can visit in Dripping Springs. I believe it's 6 days a week right now. I'll put a map to that location below. They have Alice's Restaurant there, which is a barbecue and live fire restaurant. I recently interviewed the pitmaster there, Scott Fogel. Amazing stuff they're doing there. But they're truly known for their bourbon, gin, rum. And when the fog of COVID starts to lift, they'll be doing tours of their distillery as well. But you can now go to their property, eat, drink, be merry. Again, that's treatyoakdistilling.com. And I have a website at Kevin's BBQ Joints. Check out all these podcasts, YouTube shows, collections of things that I put together, as well as write-ups, breaking news, stories, ton of content, ton of fun stuff if you're into barbecue, pits, knives, cutting boards, really cool stuff. I'm on all social media at Kevin's BBQ Joints. If you're digging these, please subscribe. I'm putting out 2 to 3 of these per week. Try to keep you busy during this COVID stuff, but also just in general, just try to keep you informed. Lots of different facets of the barbecue world. Hope you're staying safe. Thank you for all the support. Enjoy this.
I just want people to at least see that, you know, it's a family thing.
Yeah. All right.
Take care. Have a good day. Well, good morning, Brian. How are you?
I'm great, Kevin. Thanks for calling.
How are things with the COVID? Because are you in San Rafael right now, or where are you?
I'm in San Rafael, yeah. We're just obviously north of San Francisco, and we've moved it to basically just a production facility. We took over a warehouse, and we built a series of aging rooms and production rooms and packing and shipping and things like that. So it's kind of a nondescript area that we're at.
Okay.
Kind of fun, though, because back in the downturn in 08, a lot of these warehouses went on the market, you know, technically dirt cheap. So there's a lot of people bought them. For example, Sammy Hager's bought one.
Really?
The guy from Grape bought one. There's a whole bunch of car collections all around us. I think we're the only people working in this whole district.
Are you off of downtown San Rafael? Is that kind of where?
No, north of that. We're off of Lucas Valley Road, Smith Ranch Road.
Okay.
So it's the last San Rafael exit before you reach Novato.
Oh, okay. All right.
We're just north of Terra Linda.
Okay. Yeah, it's beautiful up there. And it's hard to believe, like, sometimes when you're up there that it's part of, because it's so different. I'm in Los Angeles. It's, like, Central Coast is so different than it's, like, the Pismo, Carmel area. Then you're, it's, what an amazing state we have.
Just the rolling, normal California hills with the oaks, the valley oaks. It's really pretty.
That's really beautiful. So let's go back. I want to talk about Flannery beef and all the amazing things. And I was lucky enough to receive some on Wednesday. So I got the beef short rib, the plate, and the bacana. Uh-huh. And I'm just, it's number one, it's the most beautiful meat I've ever seen cryovac'd. And then I can't wait to actually cook it. But so it's a family business. Your father started the business?
Yeah, actually my father started that picture that's on our website. Mm-hmm. That was a business that he ran in San Francisco back in the 40s.
Okay.
They actually ran, it was a single butcher shop, and nothing but meat, no fish, no poultry, no produce. And they had 80 butchers, 80 full-time butchers in a retail store. Yeah, it was just mind-boggling. Then in 63, he left there and bought a meat concession. In those days, it was not unusual for a market to have a separate owner for the meat, a separate owner for the produce, a separate owner, you know. So that was one of those kind of things in San Francisco.
Okay.
Yeah, and so that's kind of where it started. My brother is still, they carried that on. They have a similar store going real close to the original location.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's called Brian's. We're not very innovative with naming things.
Are you a junior?
I'm a junior.
Okay.
Yeah, so I don't get full credit for that side of things. I just happen to get the name.
Okay.
So, yeah, so he started it, and then they've carried that forward. Katie and I, I kind of left early. Katie was in college, and I decided. My father raised all chiefs and no Indians. The three boys, we were vying. So I decided to go off on my own. And I replicated what they were doing over in Marin in Corte Madera. Through that store, we started the online business.
Okay.
And it was kind of a funny way it started. It was literally a customer said, I want to send some steaks to a friend of mine in New York. And we didn't have a clue how to do it. I'm not even sure we put ice in them when we shipped them.
Oh, my gosh.
So that guy had a dinner party. And from that dinner party, two of his guests called us up. And it was kind of like that.
Had you already, you had already broken off from your brothers at the time or no?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So we were running our own high-end deli. We did meat, fish, poultry, but it wasn't a deli like where you buy salami. It was all like grilled ahi tuna and Chateaubriand. And more of a you come in and take out dinner type of thing, then go home and heat it up.
That's nice.
But anyway, so yeah, well, it was pretty good. So the website started in that location.
Okay.
And then we evolved through that. A couple of restaurants approached us and wanted to carry our meat. And so then we became USDA. We became a USDA facility in order to facilitate that.
Okay.
And we actually then started shipping to Hong Kong through another situation.
Oh, interesting.
All these things, this was out of this little deli, and these were, and it reached the point, it was pretty funny, I was just reminiscing, we would have shipping boxes all over the retail cases. Like if you walk into a Safeway and you're, you know, the region where the ham is or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, the top was just all these shipping boxes because we had no place to put them other than in the retail sector. So we left there in 2000, the beginning January of 2012, and we came up to this location.
Okay.
And took a 5,000 square foot unit and just started with under 2,000 square feet of refrigeration. We just built refrigerators inside this warehouse.
Oh, wow.
We filled it. And a year ago January, we took another 4,000 feet adjacent to it, and we moved into there, too. So we're almost 10,000 feet here in this location.
Were you aging at the time with your brothers? Were you guys aging meats much?
Yeah. In fact, it was originated by my dad. My dad they always aged. The people that owned that company that he worked with were first-generation Frenchmen that were in the meat industry, and they brought the whole concept of not only the aging, but the style of butchering. Which is a European style where you hardly ever use the bandsaw. Most of it is the natural seams.
Okay.
And so you're breaking the beef down into the natural muscles and the natural seams that exist rather than cutting
fabulous.
Through. Yeah, it is pretty neat.
Before we jump forward, can you explain the difference between wet aging and dry aging?
Yeah, you know, it really is interesting. And, you know, I don't have anything against wet aging, but I do not believe it's worth a damn. And I'll tell you why. The thing that goes on in the aging process, there's two main things that are happening. One is we're evaporating the moisture. So it's I use the analogy of when you're making a demi-glaze.
Okay.
You start with a stock and you reduce it. What's happening is you're evaporating the moisture, and what's retained is intense. Mm-hmm. The flavor is intense. That actually occurs in the dry aging process. As the moisture leaves, it intensifies the flavor. The other thing, and I think almost equally as important, is any protein will have living organisms in them, the enzymes. Mm-hmm. And they're aerobic. They're triggered by air. So the minute they're introduced to a sufficient amount of air, they come alive and they start consuming what they're, you know, to be honest with you, dry aging is a controlled decay. Mm-hmm. We're allowing enzymes to break down the bond. So if you think of a, the other analogy I use for this one is a chain link fence. If you wanted to get through that fence, you don't have to remove the whole fence. You just have to remove enough links and it's going to be, there's like no fence. But what they're doing is they're breaking the cell bonds that are holding the pieces of lean to the fat, to the marbling, to the whatever. They are naturally breaking those down. So it's a tenderizing agent that's occurring. But again, remember, they're aerobic. Now, the wet aging, what that simply means is that in nowadays, everything is boxed beef. So we don't get whole quarters anymore, whole beef anymore. It comes to us in what they call primals or subprimals.
Okay.
So let's take an example, prime ribs. They will come four in a box, and they'll be cryovac'd individually. Well, now, if that cryovac is nice and tight, and through shipping it hasn't, been jostled or anything, there's, even though it's not airtight, there's not enough air coming in to trigger the enzymes. And so you can leave a tight bag out of a processing plant on your rack in a refrigerator for, I've had some company's product that I could keep it there for 2 months.
Wow.
And there's virtually nothing happening. The flip side of that is, and anybody who's ever been in not only the meat business, but in the restaurant business will attest to this. The other side of that is sometimes in shipping or delivery, those bags get jostled. They don't get opened visually, but they get jostled enough to let more air in because, again, they're permeable. What happens then is there's enough air in that bag to trigger the enzymes. Now, being a living creature, they're consuming, but they're also off-gassing.
Okay.
And if you've ever seen a package that's blown up, sometimes you forget in your own refrigerator mm-hmm. and the package is expanded like a balloon.
Uh-huh.
What that is the off-gas from the enzymes.
Well, that makes sense.
That is, has stayed in the bag. Now, when we do our dry aging, that off-gas is evaporated out with the moisture and it's the whole system, the refrigeration and the blower system removes it. And so going back to why I don't believe in wet aging, if you have a bag that's degraded and it starts to bubble like that, if you leave it in there for 10 days, 2 weeks, that odor, which we've all seen one time or another, will permeate the entire piece of meat. You know, it's not like you could trim off the outside. It's gone. It's completely into the whole thing. And so that's kind of my point. Without the enzymes, 50% of what's happening with the aging process is not happening. And so if it is happening, you run the risk of spoiling the meat by leaving it in the bag. If it's not happening, there's no, there's no gain. So in defense of wet aging, I get it because it's expensive to dry age. We figure that our shrink loss over a 4 week period of time is probably around 14 to 16%. And because of the natural mold that's growing on the outside of this meat, the darkness and everything, what has to be trimmed off when it's that old, we're losing another, again, depending on the piece, another 10 or 15%. So to a normal processor, they don't, they can take it out of that bag, call it wet aged, and sell 100% of what they bought. We're in a situation of selling 60% of what we bought. So our end up landed cost is a little higher, but we've made the decision that it's a much better product. It's where we want to be. We want to sell Bentleys. We don't want to sell Volkswagens. So,
and you have much more control, right, over dry aging than
that. Well, there is, and of course, it's an ongoing thing. We've just built a room. I haven't even perfected it yet. It's a computer-operated aging room. It's fascinating.
Wow.
It originated in the cheese industry. Have you ever seen pictures of those cheese aging rooms where they have the giant wheels of cheddar?
Uh-huh.
I used to
sell cheese I used to open up cheese shops for Murray's Cheese.
Perfect. Yeah, think about that. There's no air circulation in those rooms. And so that's one of our problems when we're dry aging, because the basic dry aging system is like a refrigerator with a heavier blower system. So we dry age at 38 degrees, but we have tremendous blowers that are circulating the air. But even at that, the ones that are down on the bottom of these racks will not age at the same rate as the ones on the top of them. Just the airflow. Nor can we put them right next to each other. Well, anyway, these cheese guys have figured out that rather than relying on airflow, they're relying on dew point. So they have a computer that, measures constantly 24/7 the dew point in that room, and change. They've actually, this room has a heater in it. Wow. If the dew point gets too high, it'll turn on the heater and it'll drop the evaporators really cold, and it'll re-equilibrate the dynamics of the room within an hour or two. So that, I think, is going to be a breakthrough, because I think that would be true control when I figure out how it works.
Yeah, that's the control that you want. Yeah, that's amazing.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm really excited about that, but we haven't had time. I mean, I haven't had time, and I, going back to school, I never paid attention to the physics.
I know.
So I've got to relearn dry bulb and dew point and all the rest of this stuff, but I'm working on it.
Yeah, it'll become second nature. But yeah, same with me. Like there's certain things that I was really fascinated, excited, and then there's certain things the number wise. Like I love math, but that part wasn't exciting to me, and I kind of didn't pay attention. So then, when you moved to this facility, when did Katie become involved, and then how did your business grew? Like how did you gain more restaurant clients, right?
Yeah, Katie was involved back at the store when we did the website. It was interesting. Katie was away at school, and God's going to kill me for saying this. She started out she was doing architecture and design, I think, or something like that, back in Pennsylvania. And turned out she didn't. That wasn't for her. It was not the right niche. And so she wanted to switch to art history. Oh, my God. $40,000 for art history. So anyway, with some counseling for some friends, we said, okay, look, we'll do this, but you got to learn more than who painted the picture. You got to know how to sell it or how to copyright it. So either got to take law courses or you got business courses, and we'll go along with you. Well, the school would not let her take any business courses because she was not in the school of science. She was
okay, that makes sense.
Anyway, it was like insane. So she actually got about a month later said, look, I'd like to take a break, and you mind if I come home, take a break for you, I'll come home. And she had slated to do a year of art study in Rome, which she had already been accepted into a university over there. So she wanted to take a year off. So I said, fine, we'll send a plane for you. So home she comes and got involved in the business, which again was the deli store. But we had started the shipping, and it dawned on me. I said, Katie, I said, I wanted you to learn business. I said, we have a side business. We have this website. You can take credit cards. We have a product. We have a presence. Here, do something with it. In 6 months, she tripled it.
Oh.
Went nuts. And looking back, I think the secret that I didn't have enough sense to realize this, I guess she was probably 23, something like that, or younger. She had the authority. So she was able to make a decision and have to live with the consequences if the sale worked or if you lost money, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a dynamic thing for her that she kind of got the bug. She did leave and go to Rome thinking she could run it remotely, two things. Apparently the web service in Rome is like intermittent, always crashing on her and like that. So anyway, after 6 months of Rome, she said, hey, look, I'd rather come back and get involved in the business. And so she's honestly running it now. You know, I'm taking a step back. She's and of course, like, we would not have this conversation if it wasn't for her to even set this up for me.
Yeah, that was nice.
So she's doing things like Instagram and running our website and up, you know, it's great. So yeah, so that's kind of how she got into it, and now she's running the entire business right now.
Wow, she's doing an awesome job. And your product, I want to talk, so is it primarily Holstein cows?
Yeah, we evolved to the point right now where we're doing, I'll bet, 95% of our product is Holstein.
Can you explain why and about Holstein?
I stumbled across it accidentally because I'm always looking for a better product. I just constantly got my ear to the ground to who's got a better product. And a supplier said, I've heard of this company. They're supposed to have something really great. So I said, okay, give me a whole case because you can always salt the mine. I didn't want to.
Yeah, that's true. No, for sure.
So I took the sealed case, and it was a more expensive product, and I didn't know that it was Holstein. All I knew it was USDA Prime.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the box of four, three of them were good, but they were not worth the extra money. The fourth one was, holy S, I've never seen something so beautiful in my life. I mean, it was like a revelation. And so I got on the phone that afternoon to that company and said, hey, man, I like your product. This number four piece, I'll pay you even more than you're asking if I can have those.
Yeah.
I can't pay you the extra for the average stuff. But so He said, well, come on down and you can pick your own beef. I said, oh, shit. So I was on the plane the next day. And anyway, it didn't work out because they were processing at, and I'll tell you who it was. I mean, I've got nothing but good things. It was Brandt, Eric Brandt from Brandt Beef.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Basically down in southeastern California, down in Brawley.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to introduce me to this. But there was no discussion of Holstein, and it didn't really, I never thought to ask. It was just, you know, it wasn't on my radar.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, long story short, that's how we evolved. But one thing I noticed is the Holsteins have a very small eye. Like, for example, a New York strip, a boneless New York strip from an Angus steer will be 14 or 15 pounds. The same thing from a Holstein will be 10 pounds, maybe 11. The diameter is smaller. We get some New Yorks that are the size of a large filet.
Oh, really?
And it was interesting because going back to that day when I went down to pick the beef, they were very large carcasses. They were like 800, 850-pound carcasses. Normally, we were using a 650 or 700-pound Angus carcass to get the size of a steak that you could, you know, like the typical ribeye size.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these were, you know, much bigger, 150 pounds bigger carcasses, but they had smaller eye. And I just thought, well, that's interesting.
That's fascinating.
I never thought about it. Anyway, it took me about 6 months to figure this thing out, that it was a completely different and that it was Holstein. Then it made a world of sense. Because if you think about when you're seeing live animals in the field, the Angus look like fire plugs. They're 5'10", 210, they're buff, they're, you know. Whereas a Holstein, a dairy animal, looks like they haven't eaten in a week.
Mm-hmm.
The bones, the hips are sticking up, the shoulders are sticking up, you can count the ribs. But that's a bigger animal than the Angus. A full-grown Holstein is a bigger animal than the Angus. But what they're more gangly, their bone structure is altogether different. And so while it's a bigger carcass, your net product, from our perspective, is less.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one reason. That's one reason that a lot of butcher shops don't want to touch it, because their cutting percentages are less than from an Angus.
Yeah.
The other reason is really an interesting thing, and this is true of almost any industry. It's the blinders.
Uh-huh.
It's like, oh, we don't use that. That's a dairy animal. It's not a beef animal. And, you know, it's like, I've had lots of conversations with people that have that attitude. And I say, you know, you're missing a bet here.
Are Holsteins raised specifically for dairy and then they transition to use them for beef?
These are the males. These are the males that have no future in dairy. So these are the males that would be going to the, it's caged veal. It's where they take the veal.
Yeah.
Interesting thing, when you wean a calf from the cow, if you move that calf to a pasture just to eat grass, within a week the meat will turn red. So if you were to process that calf a week of being in the pasture, would be red like beef. If you process that calf the minute it was weaned, it would be white like copy paper.
Huh.
Yeah, like the veal that you understand.
Yeah,
so what they've done is they've take the calves, they don't let them anywhere near the pasture, and they feed them like formula. You know, it's basically a skim milk formula, and control them and things like that. And they'll grow a calf that'll be 600, 700 pounds.
Wow.
I mean, that's like a baby ewe.
Yeah.
This group of people, Brandt's family was predominant in this. They said, we don't like that style of raising these animals. We're going to see what happens if we put them in the pasture along with, like, Angus. So they were really the pioneers on this whole thing.
Sounds like it, yeah.
Some of the stories are hilarious because think about this. A dairy animal lives on, you know, real close to the barn, to the milking barn. They never really are out roaming the hills, mm-hmm. right?
True.
They don't have the institutional knowledge of grazing. Sometimes if they put them out in the pasture, they would stand there.
They have no idea what to
do. Wait for the food to be brought to them. So it's been a trick. And also, I mean, I think that's helped the quality of the beef because it's a continual supplement.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they're in a pasture, it could be the most idyllic pasture in the world. You're going to do supplemental feed, and they're feeding the Holstein a much longer period of time than the Angus. Far, far longer number of days on additional feed.
What's the flavor difference?
The flavor difference is more rich and more consistent. If we ever have a chance to physically get together, I would bring an Angus steak and a Holstein steak. And in 2 seconds, you would be able to see what I'm going to talk about.
Okay.
The marbling in an Angus will have, and the marbling, for anyone who doesn't know, are the specks of fat within the eye of the meat, within the steak itself. The Angus will have intermittent marbling. It'll have a large chunk, and when I say large chunk, maybe the head of a thumbtack.
Yeah, yeah.
But it'll be a large one, then it'll be a little bit of gap, then it'll be some little ones, it'll be another large one, then it'll be a little bit of a gap. And so it'll be, if you look at that, you can see, well, this is more fatty in this little section than the other. If you looked at the Holstein, there's virtually no of that large fat, but there's a plethora of the pinprick fats.
The intermittent, wow.
So it's almost like they describe wine that's smooth on your palate.
Mm-hmm.
When you have one of the Angus that I've described, if you're really paying attention, one bite can be through the roof flavor-wise because that's a high proportion of the marbling in that section, and the next one can be a leaner section, and it'll, so you could have dips.
No, I've had that. I noticed that. Yeah.
With the Holstein, because it's just this milky way, it's more uniform. It's like this thing's just like unbelievable. Another interesting thing about this, what I'm going to say now is all conjecture. I have no scientific knowledge of this, but I know I'm right.
Okay. I love it.
When they're in pasture, when they're being fed, they are doing something different with that feed. Now think about the reason that the Angus are 5'10", 2'10", is all animals have a certain amount of energy. Think of feed as energy. They have a certain amount that they need to ingest just to grow, to put on the body mass, to reach maturity. So anytime they have extra food, they're doing something else with it. Angus are notorious for loading up the outer fat, the outer bark that would be on the outside of a New York or the outside of the rib. And when they have excess energy, it generally goes there. Well, now think about these Holsteins. You can always see their ribs.
Uh-huh.
What are they doing with their excess energy? Now, the males obviously aren't producing milk, and they're not putting the fat on the outside of the loin, right? So they've got to be doing something else. I'm convinced they're starting to marble, even on grass.
That makes sense. It's like, again, not scientific, but it makes complete sense.
Yeah. And so I'm just, you know, we never turned back. Once the consistency, the quality, it also was a great opportunity for us to expand our restaurant trade because we were able to introduce a high-quality, beautiful steak that restaurateurs could drop the portion size because a 12-ounce Angus ribeye, for example, is only going to be maybe a little over half an inch thick, maybe 3/4 if you're lucky.
Yeah.
So they had to go 16, 18 ounces so that it didn't look like a minute steak to the diner.
Yeah.
We can cut an inch and a half, 12-ounce New York. It's the center of the plate is just gorgeous.
Gorgeous, yeah, gorgeous. That would be.
Those are the mitigating things, part of the reason that we're just in love with this whole thing.
When Katie came on board and did the online, were you selling online to wholesale as well, or was it just retail? And then how did you expand the restaurant business?
It was 100% to private individuals all across the country.
Okay.
We started out shipping to New York. One of our first customers was a telltale out of school. Andre Agassi, who was a customer at the store.
That's interesting.
Moved out of Marin, we were shipping to him. And that was pretty funny because we were literally using orange boxes and twining them together and that whole thing. But the website eventually got going. And like I say, Katie really, you know, got it hip and moving. And then we started getting involved with the wine people because it makes world of sense.
It makes complete sense, like meta, yeah.
Totally simpatico. And the major breakthrough is we picked up as a customer Robert Parker, he actually spoke about us on his website.
He has a little bit of influence.
Yeah. Oh man, it was just, you know, it was remarkable. We have a quote. I asked him if I could use it. He gave me permission. He actually sent me an email saying, "I finally found out what a 100-point steak tastes like."
Oh, that's so great. That's fantastic. Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
That's kind of how it's gone, and then. Throughout this whole thing, the restaurants started becoming more and more to us, and we found ourselves literally with about 10 or 15 restaurants that we were selling to without trying. It was just they had all said, "Will you sell to us?" And then one day there was the eureka moment. What if we try? Why don't we try to sell to restaurants? And so, prior to this, you know, restaurant shutdown, which I just feel so bad for, so you know, they're just brutalized. It's just awful. But we were up to about 150 restaurants that we were taking care of. And I just, my heart goes out to all those people.
I'm in that business, the barbecue and meat business. And I'm friends with so many restaurateurs and it crushes me because a lot of them have temporarily closed too, just to hold.
We're blessed because the retail side through our website has burgeoned. And so we've been able to keep everybody working. In fact, we were building a facility in Los Angeles that was like a week from opening.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
That we we just locked it up and brought people back up here because that site was going to be strictly restaurant service down there.
Oh, that makes sense.
So we're okay, but it's just, you know, it's a tough time for
a lot of people. and their website's gorgeous, and I'll put links to it all below, and I'll promote it like crazy because I have a list of where people can purchase meat online. I started it like the couple days after the shutdown because I wanted people to have at least the ability to, you know, pick and choose and still be able to order. And you guys are still full bore. Yeah. And the website is gorgeous now. She's done a great job.
Thanks. That's all Katie's doing. In fact, she's got another one in the wings that we're hoping to have out in a month.
Oh.
That's even better. But, you know, the thing is we're old fashioned. It's like I drive her crazy. I'll bet 3,000 or 4,000 of my customers have my cell phone. I'm adamant that if you have a question, call me. I'll talk to you. I've had restaurants call me because a diner at the table doesn't believe that it's Holstein. So they'll put me on the phone and I can talk to them.
Oh, really? So what's going to happen with your transition when you leave? Are you going to still do it?
No, I've been taken out of the C-suite, so to speak, and I'm in the production room. But I'm more moving into sourcing and things that I could do to like learn that aging room, the one I was describing.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. So you're not leaving, just transitioning.
Yeah, I'm going to move to, you know, more advice and sourcing and things like that, you know. So we'll see where it goes.
People could still call you and ask you questions, right?
Oh, yeah. It's kind of like that. And we're unusual, and it's tough right now. I mean, it's a good tough, but we sell very little of our product for pre-cut frozen. Like when a person places the order and says, okay, well, I want it shipped on Monday morning when that order is dropped, that's when that is processed. So that hamburger
is good to know.
The steak is cut that day. So we always use the best product mode. So that day we will start with the very best product we have in the shelf, and that's what we'll ship. Wow. And we do have, for example, we do a little bit of frozen when we, if you were to order 4 New York steaks, I would assume you're having a dinner party. And so we're going to give you 4 from the same piece so that they look alike, that you, when you plate them, it looks
that's
fine.
Smart.
And we will end up with 1 or 2 cuts per loin that won't really match the next loin. They'll look differently. So we actually have developed this thing where we'll take those, we call them mismatched, and we will package at the end of the day and freeze those, and we sell them on our website as a mismatched New York. Now, it's every bit of that best steak that we started with in the morning. It just doesn't look like all the others.
Oh, that's great to know. Okay, I'll put a link to that. That's really interesting.
Oh, it's kind of like our outlet mall, if you will.
if you're not
worried about will they match, you're going to get hell of a good steaks.
So let's talk about what you guys offer. What are the different cuts that you guys offer, and what are your most popular?
Well, we keep it pretty simple. We're doing really the A cuts primarily. So we're doing anything that comes from the rib or the loin. So we're doing boneless ribeyes, bone-in rib steaks. We're doing Saratoga steaks. That's the name we came up with. It's when you pull the rib cap, which is the spinalis. When you pull the rib cap off of the, you know, a ribeye steak where it has like an outer cap that's mm-hmm. a little darker texture and color,
yeah. mm-hmm.
but that's what the flavor is. When you do prime rib, everybody goes for that outer part.
Yeah,
what
is that called? I've heard, what is it called?
The rib cap.
Okay.
But the Latin name is spinalis, but it's the rib cap.
Okay. That's why I thought it was spinalis.
If that's removed, then what happens is the ribeye, which normally has a certain amount of fat, the tail or that fat that's in the middle of it, that can no longer stay with the remaining piece. So if you trim that out, you end up with a ribeye fillet. And so we do that on occasion too. On the New Yorks, on the loins, we'll do porterhouse, T-bone, bone-in New York steaks, boneless New York steaks. We do fillets, 2 or 3 sizes of fillets. We limit it to 10-ounce fillets as a maximum because, again, going back to the smaller size, it would be overwhelmingly thick to get beyond a 10-ounce fillet, so we cap it at that. Then the other item that, and these are all prime. We do everything is prime.
Yeah.
We do prime hanger steak, which is one of our top sellers. It's a marvelous, at the prime level, I really would not be interested in at the choice level,
mm-hmm.
but at the prime level, the flavor is dramatic and they're fantastic. And it's a great cut of meat because I think we sell it for, I think, $35. It's guaranteed to at least 1.5 pounds. They usually ship it about 1.75 pounds. But they're completely trimmed. The nerve is removed. We have to cut them into 2 pieces to get the nerve out of them. But So it's 100% usable meat. So what you get is 100% usable, ready to grill, like right out of the
And what a great price. They're, like, it's your, and I was noticing, too, your prices for what you're getting are phenomenal. They really are.
Well, I appreciate it. You know, I mean, I'm real sensitive to that. In fact, when this thing started, when this whole restaurant shutdown thing started, we actually put everything on sale, and we're continuing every week. We're coming up with something, you know, rather than I want to participate in this. And I think we've got a great product, and I just want to price it at a fair price that's got a value, mm-hmm. and we'll go from there. So I appreciate you noticing that, because I you know, compared to others, we are.
It's not inexpensive. It's not like just going and to the, you know, supermarket getting choice or whatever, but it's to be expected, but you can tell what you're getting value-wise. It's pretty amazing. I was shocked the first, even before I had a chance to speak with you guys and or even email, I was shocked by your pricing. I thought it was, and now I've noticed that there are discounts that are popping up weekly.
Yeah, we're just doing it aggressively during this whole thing because people are stuck at home. And you know, our New York steak is not a Tuesday night dinner. It just isn't. It's an anniversary or a birthday or a promotion or, you know, it's a celebration. So we're trying to do, just like, for example, during this last 3 weeks, 4 weeks, our ground meat has moved to our fourth cellar.
I could see that.
Well, because people, you know, I mean, we got to be a little economical. They can't have a steak every night. So we're noticing that. We're trying to come up with other things. We're probably going to launch skirt steaks and some things that would be lower price points, but what a good value.
What's the blend for the ground beef?
Well, you know, we did have this thing originally. We called it the Burger Builder. It was just phenomenal. We gave you the choice to pick your burger.
Oh, interesting.
There was like, I don't know, someone said there were 7,000 or 8,000 combinations that you could choose. You could take prime brisket and Wagyu short ribs and bacon. You could tell us, and we'd put it together for you. Well, the USDA put a kibosh on that a couple of years ago. They've gotten really strict on testing. Mm-hmm. They want everything tested, every batch tested. But now, as I was mentioning, when you order 4 pounds of hamburger from us, we grind 4 pounds of hamburger for you. Well, that's considered a batch with the USDA, and so they want it tested. Oh. How the hell am I going to do that? I'm going to spend $100 to send it to a laboratory? Anyway, so long story short, short answer to your question, what we did is we went back and looked at when we were doing the Burger Builder and allowing our customers to design their own burger. It was the 80-20 rule. 80% of all the blends fell into one of three categories. So now what we're doing is we're making those three. We call it the traditional would be the middle of the road, great flavor, probably an 80% lean, but a nice fresh flavor. Then we call one the rich blend, which would be reminiscent if you were using a lot of Wagyu or a lot of brisket, a moist, high moisture content fat, probably a 75-25. So it's a little fattier, great, great, great flavor. Yeah. Then the other one we call the adventurous blend, which is actually the leanest of the three, interesting enough. Huh. But what we use is we use the dry aged ends, because when we're cutting the steaks, we're removing those from the steak. Now, it's technically no different than brisolo. It's air-dried beef. So we cut them off, trim them up, and then use that. What you get is that intense flavor. I was talking about the demi-glaze illusion. You'll get this intense flavor with a very lean piece of meat because this is the face of a New York strip.
So it's more intense, much more intense, even though it's leaner.
Like a 15% fat burger that will taste like a 25% burger because it has this dry. So that's the three that we do. So it's like, I tell people, if you're just starting, do the traditional and then move to one of the other ones. Is, you know, you'll find the happy medium. You'll one of those three will be exactly what you want.
Doesn't Kevin Meehan have a?
Yes, yeah. I just thought of that because it's unusual. We've done something unusual for Kevin. We've actually created one in collaboration with him. He was integral on doing this. We were putting blends together and setting them down to him, and he was cooking them and tweaking them. And we were he and Katie primarily over probably 6 weeks. Took 6 weeks to figure out exactly what he wanted.
Okay.
It's a proprietary blend for Kevin, but it's interesting. It's got some of everything in it. It's got some of the dry aged flavor to it, but it's got a little bit of the Wagyu taste to it. It's quite a good blend without being real fatty.
Doesn't it have a short rib in there, or am I?
We pulled away from the Wagyu short ribs because they were in the combination they were too fatty. You have to be careful when you're doing a blend like that you can get crazy and get too much fat in there.
So do you guys have Wagyu as well?
Not so much anymore. We do a little bit of it. We used to use it a lot in our burger blends, but what we have to do now to deal with this testing is we have to buy a bulk product where we can get 8 or 10 cases of a single item. Okay. And then we can test that. It's got to be out of the same lot. We test it, and that basically clears that batch. So that's how we get around being able to test every single batch. So we cannot, we can't have that many variations.
Yeah.
So we've had to tighten it up so the Wagyu went. But we can replicate the Wagyu with brisket. Interesting. Here I go off the rails again.
That's okay. I like it.
Wagyu fat is considered really healthy. I never remember whether the saturated or the unsaturated is supposed to be the good one or the bad one.
Neither do I, but I know you.
Wagyu fat is what's considered the good one.
Yep.
Angus beef, normal cattle, Holstein the same way, is the other one, generally speaking.
Yeah.
With the exception of the brisket. The brisket of an Angus beef is different fat than the rest of the animal.
Huh.
It's like Wagyu. If you touch Wagyu fat and you touch brisket fat from an Angus, it's the exact same thing.
That's interesting. That's a cool little aside. I never knew that.
Yes. The brisket is the healthy fat. And that's, you can see probably why for generations the brisket was such a mainstay.
Uh-huh. Well, and a lot of people that listen to this show or cook in Texas, that's brisket. Brisket's a staple. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
Not all of them are using Angus prime. But
going to your question, if you were to take brisket and combine it with anything from Wagyu, it'd be overpowering.
Yeah, too much.
You'd go too far.
Yeah,
too
yeah.
far on that. Just like, for example, when we used to do the burger blend that you could pick, we would not allow people to put a hanger steak with the dry-aged ends because they would just, it would overwhelm each other.
It That's was like, for sure.
There were certain minor rules, not very many.
Is there a specific amount of aging that you feel is too much? Like, is there a point that gets beyond?
Yeah, I do. I think it's a straight line from 0 to 30. It's getting better every single day. From 30 to 45, it's continuing to get better, but it's the line is growing slower. I think 45, 50 is the witching point. We've gone much farther, but you run the risk that it can go over the edge and crash, particularly on the prime ribs, on the ribs. If you think about the end of a rib, one of them is right next to where the New York strip, the difference between a ribeye and a New York strip is where they cut the knife.
Yeah,
that's one side is New York, one side. And then it moves up towards the shoulder, and then it starts to separate out, and you think that's why you get different looking ribeye steaks. One will look like a New York, one will look altogether different with more of that rib cap, that's mm-hmm. spinalis on it. Well, anyway, as you move towards that shoulder, there are more separations in that piece of meat. It's not one chunk of meat. There's like 3 or 4 muscles that are together. Well, it's possible for the age to walk in one of those seams. And we take stuff out way out. We've taken stuff out 100 days. We have found when you start to cut that steak, obviously you trim the outside, everything's fine and dandy. But if it's walked in, it'll be in there for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 inches. And the only way you can get it out of there is you got to cut the steak into skinny. You got to hard to get it out. So that's one technical problem. What happens is, from a flavor point of view, I think from beyond 60 days, you're moving into what you've been familiar with is the cheese.
Yeah, I agree.
You're getting that blue cheese, and it can get overwhelming.
That funk is
the other thing that you can happen, and this will happen on short loins where we get the porterhouse or the T-bone or the bone in New York, the vertebrae, even though it doesn't appear to be, there's marrow in that vertebrae, those will sometimes sour with long-term aging.
Oh, interesting.
We've had something where we've cut and the nose is like, oh my God, where did this come from? It smelled like a wet-age bag that went bad. But then we took the bone off of it and separated it, threw the bone away and let the steak sit for an hour. Absolutely fine. I mean, it had the flavor that I'm not a fan of, but it didn't have that odor.
So the odor
was really... It was traced to the crenellations of the vertebrae bone. So those are issues. We do the long-term aging kind of for larks. We have a lot of our customers that like to do different tastings. We're doing one right now. It's called a flight. It's a mini flight. We're doing a 30-day age and a 60-day age. Exact same thing, a ribeye steak or rib steak.
But that's interesting. It's nice to get that different.
Exactly. So they can have a dinner, and they can do one with 30, one with 60 side by side. and actually, you know, we're thinking of coming up with tasting notes.
You should. That would be so cool.
It'd be just a lot of fun.
I could talk to you. Like, we've talked to almost about 50 minutes, and I could talk another hour, but I know that people, their attention spans are a certain point. Sure. I'd love to maybe do a part two eventually, or maybe do in person.
Anytime you like.
Right now, what's your favorite go-to cut?
Me, the ribeye.
The ribeye?
The ribeye and I love fat. I think the fat is, because that's where all the flavor comes from.
Yeah.
So, whereas I abhor fillets. They're soft, but
same with me. You know, I hate them too.
Toss or something on it. The New York steak is a fair compromise, but the ribeye, because of the fat, and especially when it moves towards the shoulder, where you have more of that rib cap, that to me is the best.
Is ideal. I mean, you know, and I hate to say it, my little brother, he likes a fillet, well, butterflied and well done. That's his favorite.
Oh, really? One of the things that's interesting about going back to this Holstein and the marbling structure,
mm-hmm.
you can cook Holstein well done and it will not dry out.
Oh, interesting.
Huh. Yeah, it's remarkable. It's like the magic bean. So I would love to do this again. You're welcome anytime you want up here.
Okay.
Thank
you.
Appreciate it very much. Great talking to you.
Have a great weekend. All right, take care.
You're well. Take care.